various forms of a very familiar rhyme about the calendar circulated. 30 days, half September, April, June, November. February has 28 alone, all the rest have 31. Excepting leap year, that's the time when February days are 29. This is the leap year. This is the leap day of the leap year. And since I'm not going to have in my lifetime another chance to preach on a leap day of a leap year, I looked it up. And I have no illusions of living till 20,056. I thought it would be interesting this morning to look at the calendar. Look at leap year. The calendar, of course, plays an extremely significant role in our lives, sometimes a silent role. We take it for granted. But nevertheless, the role of the calendar touches some of the most important psychic roots of our being. And I'd like to examine these this morning. So let's start with today, the 29th of February. As you know, it takes the Earth about 365 days and approximately 6 hours to travel on its elliptical orbit around the Sun. So at the end of each year, the 365-day year slips a little bit behind. And about once every 4 years, we have to add a full day. 29th of February, to keep the year and the actual movement of the earth and the heavens in line. Now, why does the leap day occur at this time? Strange. At the end of the second month of the year, we add an extra day. And the answer, of course, goes back to the time of Julius Caesar, the year 43 before the Common Era. When Julius Caesar, then the Pontifex Maximus of Rome, and an Alexandrian astronomer named Sosigenes, set down the basic rules which still govern our calendar today. And in those years, February was the last month of the year. March was the first month. Our own calendar still bears the skeleton of that ancient calendar. December, our 12th month of the year, bears the Latin word decem, which means 10. It is the 10th month. September, our 9th month, really means the 7th month. October, the 10th month, really means the 8th month, and so on. In those days, then, February was simply the end of the year, and a day was added about once every 4 years to allow the calendar to be kept in line. But let me add a Department of Trivia note. If you're ever asked, how often does leap year come? The answer is not leap year comes every 4 years. Leap year comes every 4 years, except about once every 125 years. So you see, the ellipse of the Earth around the Sun requires 365 days, 0.24, 0.22 days, which is just a little less than 6 hours, less than a quarter of a day. And each 4 years, we slip back a little. And so the rule is that on every century year, if the year can be divided by 500, we add the leap year, and if it cannot, we do not add a leap year. 1900, if you can remember back that long ago, there was no leap year. In the year 2000, there will be a February 29th. Now, all that is important to astronomers and calendar makers, but not very important to us. But what is important to us, I believe, are the folk tales behind the leap year and what they suggest about our attitude towards time and towards the calendar. Remember, by way of perspective, how much the calendar means to us, even today. I'm sure you have a calendar on your kitchen cabinet, you have a calendar on your desk, you probably carry a pocket calendar and appointment book. Our lives are to a very large degree governed by the calendar. Now, why the leap day and why the leap year and why the kinds of folk tales associated with it? What is the leap year and what is the 29th of February? In a sense, it's Sadie Hawkins Day. It's the time of year, and it is the year on which, according to the old folk tales, a woman could face down and propose to a man, instead of what was presumed to be the way, the man to face down and to propose to the woman. Now, this folk tale is not an invention of Al Capp. It didn't originate in the comic strips of, you know, Lil Abner. There's an old apocryphal bit of English history that can be found in any number of ordinary history books. In the year 1288, Queen Margaret of Scotland issued a royal edict which said, in effect, that on the leap year, any woman could propose to any man, and he had to accept her unless he was already engaged or prepared to pay a 100-pound fine. That's rather expensive. And the story occurs in French folk literature and German folk literature. Stephen said that St. Patrick ordered this leap year habit for all of Ireland. Now, what's behind it? Is it simply an early form of woman's lib? Not at all. What's behind it is a simple fact that we are creatures of habit, that we require routine, that we live in a world which is full of the unexpected, of chaos and confusion, that we do not like to think of that world as confused, to think the thoughts that are maddening. We like to feel that everything is ordered and in place. Routine is encouraged. And so when the calendar goes out of kilter, we feel that life itself is somehow out of kilter. And in the medieval world, what was more erratic than that the role in courtship of the sexes should be reversed? Man likes to think that his life is in tune with time. And if time is out of tune, then life must be, in a sense, out of tune, just dissonance. And so these stories originate. And you know, we find an echo of this in our own Bible. We're a people of the covenant. We believe that there's a contract, or we believe that there was a contract between God and us, that if we were obedient to his will, it would be well with us, and if we failed his will, misfortune would occur to us. And somehow the existence of this contract with God gave Israel a great deal of psychic health. But the earliest covenant, the earliest contract between God and man is not the contract of Sinai, the contract of the commandments, but it's the contract, the covenant of the rainbow. You remember the great flood that covered the earth in Noah's day? It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Then it ceased to rain, and finally the oceans fell back within their borders, and the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat, and Noah descended. From that point, God made a covenant with Noah, a covenant of the calendar, a covenant which guaranteed Noah and all of his descendants, all of us, that seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease while the earth remains. And then the Bible goes on to say, and Noah bless God. Mental health requires the calendar, requires a sense of the predictable, a sense of the familiar, a sense of routine. This encourages us, carries us along, and allows us to live with blinkers, with blinders on, without seeing the chaos, the darkness, the emptiness which is beyond us, which we cannot control, which is there, but which we, through the calendar, try to deny. And if you want to find in your own lives a reminder of the psychic importance of the calendar, can you remember back to the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, when he first ordered Americans to place the Thanksgiving not on a particular day of the month of November, but on a particular Thursday, third or fourth Thursday in the month of November. Americans didn't like it. It destroyed something of our sense of balance. Nor have we taken well to the recent decision to take the two presidents' birthdays in February and to make them into a single President's Day on a Monday in February. We are creatures of habit. We require the routine. We require the sense of the stately passage of time through history. If time is in pace, if all is calm with the calendar, somehow we're calm within. And when things are erratic, when we have to add a day to the year, when we recognize that we cannot completely comprehend time, there are things out there we'd rather not think about, then we're distraught, nervous, tense. And the stories which we draw out of our own unconscious become the kind of stories which are behind the leap year, which suggest that during such a time, life itself becomes quite other than it routinely is, and because it is that way, ought to be. Now let's look at our own Jewish calendar. It's a fascinating subject. There's a great literature about it, a very complicated subject. Complicated because when astronomers have managed to put down for us the passage of moon, sun, and earth through the skies, they find that there's no way to adjust all of these phases into one simple system. But the Jewish calendar is in its own way a very magnificent invention. It has two basic components. One is arbitrary, inflexible, inviolate, and the other measures time but has a certain degree of flexibility to it. The arbitrary part of our calendar is the week. The Hebrew word for week is Shavua, which comes from simply from the noun Sheva, which means seven. The idea of dividing the days into sections of seven is absolutely arbitrary invention. Why not divide them into six or eight, or as the ancient Egyptians did, into ten, and have some kind of decimal way of numbering time? Now, we take the week for granted. Part of the secular calendar. The Greek and Romans took it over from the Hebrews. The Hebrews, in turn, took it over from those who lived in Mesopotamia. We don't know why the ancient Babylonians and Assyrians divided their days by sections of seven. We know that seven was a sacred number. We know that seven is an indivisible number. We know that in their astronomy, they believed that there were seven basic planets in the sky, and that somehow seven came to represent the basic structure of the universe. The great menorah, which burned in the temple in Jerusalem, had seven branches corresponding to their idea of the orbit, the size, the numbering of the heavens. But what's interesting with the seven-day division is that we as Jews didn't allow it to remain what it had been in Mesopotamia, simply a numbering, a notching of a piece of wood, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and you begin all over again. We turned this division of seven to some sacred purpose. We created the Sabbath. We ended each division of seven by a holy day on which man and beast could find rest and relief and refreshing the soul. Now, in very earliest biblical times, the Sabbath seems to have been a time for special sacrifices at the shrine and for a day of leisure and family enjoyment. Later on, study and worship and the prohibitions of Sabbath work came in. But whatever the way in which the Sabbath was observed, it's very clear that this regular, fixed, immutable numeration of seven, each 7 days ending with God's day, the Sabbath, has a great deal to do with the survival of the Jew through the rough time which has beset our history. Whatever was happening outside, pogrom or war or exile, insecurity, whatever it might have been, the Jew knew that every seventh day there was a Sabbath, that life had a predictable routine which nothing could interrupt. God had ordained it and fixed it for all time. So the Sabbath is one of the great explanations, in my mind, of Jewish survival. One day in seven, whatever was happening, however cold the howling wind, the Jew had his home and his family, in the day that was uniquely his. And this sense of the Sabbath is one which I think we sometimes forget as far as its importance is concerned in the survival of our people. Now, what of the calendar itself? The day, the month, the year. These, of course, in our calendars and all others, must correspond to the movement of the heavenly body. We say in our liturgy, day follows day in endless succession. But day, and for the ancients, was not a matter of 24 hours measured by a mechanical instrument, the watch. It was a measure of sunlight and darkness. And no two succeeding days had exactly the same length of sunlight and of darkness. And so the ancient day was measured by visual observation. And the ancients had really two things that they could measure, sunrise or sunset. It's easier to measure sunset. When the sun rises, you see a great effulgence of light. It's hard to see the orbit of the sun itself. But as the sun sets, the line of the sphere is more clearly visible. And so the Jewish day begins at sundown and lasts from sundown to sundown, and one day is longer than next or shorter than the next, depending upon the season and time of the year. We have our days, and basically we have our months. And our months are, as the word itself suggests, month comes from an old root moon, add an O, M-O-O-N-T-H. It's the orbit of the moon around the earth. And that orbit takes 29 days and a fraction. The ancients had no way of measuring the time of the moon's orbit around the earth. What they looked for was the conjunction of the moon and the sun and the earth, or more immediately, what they looked for was the new moon. And in ancient biblical times, the new moon, Rosh Chodesh, was one of the most important occasions of the year. It happened routinely during the year. There were people put in all the mountains around Jerusalem, around the shrines before Jerusalem became the central shrine. And the minute they saw the first fringe of light signaling the new moon after the total darkness of the previous month, they ran down to the temple, and they were quizzed there, as witnesses are always investigated by the priests in the Sanhedrin, the court. And if they were trustworthy witnesses, the priests proclaimed the new moon, the new month. And then bonfires were lit upon the hilltops around Jerusalem, and there were fire stations all over the country. And soon one fire was lit on a second mountain and a third. And within a matter of minutes, people as far north as Syria knew that the new moon had been announced. Now, why was it so important to know about the month, to be precise? Because in the Bible, in God's word, God had precisely enumerated the time on which the great ceremonies and holidays are to be observed. The Sabbath is observed simply by numbering 7 days from the previous Sabbath. But Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and the pilgrimage festivals are numbered by their day in the month. Sukkot is the 15th day of the seventh month, according to the Bible. Passover, according to the Bible, begins on the 14th day of the first month at dusk. Now, you must know the first day of the month in order to know what the 14th day is, or the 15th day is, when it will happen, when it will fall. And since each lunar month may run slightly over or slightly under 29 and a half days, the new moon may be observed 30 days after the previous new moon, or 31 days. And in order for all Israel to observe the holiday on the same day, there had to be some principle of unity. Which is to say that from our earliest times, the sense that through the calendar, man bound himself not only to his God, but to his fellow Jew, was of primary significance. We are dispersed people that have long been dispersed. We were scattered even in biblical times to Egypt, to Mesopotamia, to Syria, and elsewhere. What binds the Jews together? That's simply a basic literature, a set of common values. The literature remains, but our understanding of that literature has changed from time to time and is often very different from community to community. But the point is that wherever Jews live, they have worshipped the holidays on the same day. We are bound by time far more than we are bound by ideas or values. And though in the second or third century before the Common Era, the Jews of Alexandria, the Hellenized, the Greek-speaking Jews of Alexandria, had a far different understanding of Judaism than the sages and Aramaic-speaking Jews of Palestine, they were bound together, these two communities, because they shared a calendar, because they worshiped Sukkot, Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, on the same day. And the great care was lavished to see that at least some of the great holiday was observed by all Jews during the same day. Essentially, that's why we have 2 days for most of our holidays in the diaspora, because now we are scattered wide. And because of the time zones and the difference in the clock for us and for those, in Israel, you almost need 2 days of a holiday to make sure that the time that Rosh Hashanah is being observed in Jerusalem overlaps to some degree the time when Rosh Hashanah is observed in Cleveland. The calendar provides then a sense of the familiar, a sense of routine, a sense of possibility, of purpose to life. And beyond that, it binds Jew to Jew and Jew to God. The calendar is a very complex entity. And the problem that the Jew faced with this calendar was how to adjust the month calendar, the lunar calendar, to the cycle of the earth around the sun, to what we call the solar calendar. Why was this important? Again, because of our Bible. Our Bible creates for us holidays which not only commemorate great ancient events, but each of the major pilgrimage festivals at least is related to a particular time or season of the year. Passover is the planting of the spring crop, the lambing season. Shavuot is the harvesting of the spring crop. And Sukkot is the Thanksgiving, the harvesting of the fall crop. If somehow the lunar calendar was not adjusted to the cycle of the earth around the sun, these holidays would slip through the year, much as Ramadan, the great Arab month of fasting and of penitence, slips through the year. The Arabs share with the Jews the lunar calendar, but they make no attempt to adjust the lunar calendar to that of the sun. They have 12 months of 29 or 30 days, and so each year Ramadan moves to a different part of the year. It slips back about 14 days. In the course of some 38 years, it has moved through the entire cycle of the year. Now, it's bad enough that with us, Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur can move from early September to early October. I often have great pity for school administrators who worry about when they should open school. They aren't smart enough to call up the rabbi and get the list of dates of Rosh Hashanah for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur for the next 10 years, but they remember that last year Rosh Hashanah came on September 5th, and so they announced that this year they're going to open school on September 8th. And don't you know it? That's the day on which Rosh Hashanah falls. The holiday can slip within some 30 days from early September to early October, and that's true of all of the other holidays of the year. Why? Because to adjust the lunar cycle to the so-called solar cycle, the ancient Jewish way is to add not a leap day, but a leap month. An extra month, 9 times in every 17 years. The second month is called the second Adar. It comes in March, usually, of the year. At a specified time in this 17-year cycle, 9 times in that cycle, we add an extra month. We inflate, intercalate, which is a technical term, the year. And as a result, when we do, the holidays move back. Where there's no extra month, the year is shorter. And so a Jewish year is not a year of 365 or 366 days. It's a year of 383 or 384 or 385 days, or a year of 337, 338, or 339 days. And when we set up a cycle of readings from the Torah, we don't set it up for the 52 weeks of the year. We set it for either 50 weeks of the year or 54 weeks of the year. There are never 52 weeks in a Jewish year. And that's why every rabbi, every Jewish professional carries a little luach, a little book which tells you exactly what day it is in the Jewish calendar as well as in the secular calendar, because the question we're most asked is not, what does it mean to be righteous? Or what should I do about my family? But when does Rosh Hashanah fall? And if you're an Orthodox rabbi, the question you're most asked is, what time is sundown on Friday so that we can light the lights? Or what time is sundown on Saturday so I can arrange my daughter's wedding late enough on Saturday night to have the party where I want it? The calendar plays a very tricky, a very important part in our lives. Must never be underestimated. It's the unity. It's that which binds us together. And interestingly, in the Mishnah, which is by and large a rather dry but terribly significant book of Jewish law, compiled in the late second, early third century of this era, one of the very few incidents recorded, one of the very few historic incidents recorded, deals with the calendar. It says that around the year 100 or 110, the man who was the patriarch of all the Jews, the titular head of the Jewish community of Palestine, in Gamaliel, had a certain way of understanding the calendar as we do, through mathematics. The temple had just been destroyed. Obviously, there was great concern that they would not be able to observe any longer the new moon from the familiar places. And so the rabbis and sages began, through their astronomy and mathematics, to work out the mathematical equations which make it possible for us to know when the new moon will come with great accuracy years and years ahead. There was also at the time a venerable scholar, one of the greatest sages of his name, a man by the name of Joshua ben Hananiah, who had in fact been Gamaliel's teacher. And Joshua ben Hananiah was of the old school. He believed that the calendar should be created only by the specific observance as it had been in the past, by the direct observance of the new moon. Now, it so happened one year that for the new moon of Tishrei, the new moon in which Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur come, two witnesses appeared at the court of Gamaliel, and they said, "We observe tonight the first signs of the new moon." Joshua ben Hananiah was in the court, and Joshua ben Hananiah knew that the testimony of these men had been invalidated by a previous court, and therefore, by strict understanding, interpretation of Jewish law, their testimony should have been thrown out in this case. But Gamaliel, who presided over the court and had the authority, accepted their testimony because it agreed with the mathematical and calendrical tables which he had established. And Joshua ben Hananiah went out of the courtroom grumbling and arguing that he would not accept this testimony, and that by his understanding, the new month started the next day. Now, this is a matter of grave consequence, because it meant that on Yom Kippur, when Gamaliel and his court would have been observing Yom Kippur, Joshua ben Hananiah would have had an ordinary day, and on the next day, when Gamaliel would have an ordinary day, Joshua and his disciples would have Yom Kippur, and the unity of Israel would have been destroyed. Gamaliel, according to the Mishnah, ordered this venerable sage, his own teacher, to appear before him on the day which, by his understanding of the old law, Yom Kippur would have fallen, with his money purse on and with a pack on his back, with a suitcase. And there's no better way to stipulate that this is an ordinary day, a work day, but by carrying things, by carrying money, by preparing for a voyage. And according to the Mishnah, Joshua ben Hananiah didn't know what to do. He went to see Rabbi Akiva, he went to see Rabbi Hanina Mendoza. He tried to understand what he should do faced with this dilemma. By all that he knew and by all the traditions that he venerated, his understanding of what had happened that day in the court made it clear that Yom Kippur should be 11 days hence rather than 10 days hence, as Gamaliel had established. And each of these other sages advised this old man that despite the fact that Gamaliel should have had reverence to your age, despite the fact that he accepted the testimony of two men who in olden times would not have been believed and given credence, Nevertheless, for the sake of the unity of Israel, the sake of the unity of the Jewish people, you must go on the day which he has, where he has ordered you to come, the day you believe to be Yom Kippur, with your money pouch on your belt, with a pack on your back, and make obeisance. And so we did. According to the Mishnah, Gamaliel came down from his chair and embraced the old man, kissed him and blessed him and thanked him. Every time that schism has developed in the Jewish tradition, it has been signaled by a break between the competing groups as far as calendar is concerned. The most ancient and long-last schism in Jewish life is between the Judeans and the Samaritans, the people who live near Samaria and in Jerusalem, in Israel today, who have their own understanding of the Bible. They believe in the Hexateuch, the five books of Moses, plus the book of Joshua. They have a very ancient script. They believe themselves to be the true Jews, and their basic argument with the ancient Judeans was not over anything except the fact that they believed that their shrine at Mount Gerizim was more holy than the Judean shrine in Jerusalem. But they signaled their break by breaking with the calendar of the ancient Hebrews. They believed that the new moon was to be declared when the sun and the earth and the moon were in direct line opposite each other. And by a few hours, this differs from the time when you may see the new moon in the heavens. And so bitter did this calendar argument become that when in Jerusalem our forefathers would light the bonfires to alert the other communities throughout that part of the world that a new moon had begun, the Samaritans got in the habit of the next day lighting other bonfires on other mountains, and so confusing the system that the rabbis had to create a wholly new system, send actual messengers who by word of mouth and by manuscript declared the new moon. And the Christians, the Judeo-Christians, the Ebionites, broke with our fathers precisely on the matter of calendar. They created a Sunday Sabbath precisely because we had Sabbath the day before. And when the Muslims came along, they showed their independence of both the Jewish and the Christian tradition by creating a Friday Sabbath, in order to break with both the Sabbath, which is ours, and the Sabbath of the Christians. Now, this has had great relevance in modern life. One of the great problems facing Reformed Judaism in the 19th century was a problem of unity, the problem of the calendar. Reformed Judaism proclaimed itself to be pragmatic. Whatever it is necessary for modern man to do in order to maintain the central values of his tradition, let him do it. But he has to drive to the synagogue on the Sabbath because we now live scattered, not simply in a small European town clustered in the ghetto. Let's drive to the synagogue on the Sabbath. It's more important to be in the synagogue than to be denied our chance to get there because it's too far away from us. We can't walk there. We live in a town where kosher food may be unavailable to us. Well, let's eat those things which are not kosher because it's important that life be sustained in the proper diet. Be maintained. Well, in the world in which they found themselves in the 19th century, the Sunday was the dominant day of rest. Men did, in fact, work in those days 6 days a week. And the Sunday was, in fact, the only day of rest. And there was great pressure in some circles of liberal Judaism to transfer the Sabbath to the Sunday, not to do what we do here, which is to maintain Kabbalat Shabbat and the Sabbath, all the worship which is traditional, and add to it the worship of the weekday, which is traditional in Jewish life, but to do away entirely with the Sabbath, with Friday and Saturday worship, and to concentrate all worship on the Sunday. And to go further, to take all of the holidays and to place them on convenient secular or Christian holidays. What's the difference if we confirm our children on Shavuot or on the nearest Sunday? What is the difference if we move Passover from the day appointed to it to the time when our children are out of school, the spring vacation, when we can truly have an occasion that is a joyous and relaxed together? And those arguments went on for many years in liberal Judaism, and they were resolved only because deep within the heart of most Jews, there was the recognition that if Reform Judaism broke with the calendar, it would in fact have broken with the people of Israel. It would have had, in fact, created itself a schismatic movement. We could violate the halakha as much as it was deemed desirable to do. We could deny many of the assumed values of the old tradition. We could have questions of revelation and questions of ancient and medieval theology. But as long as we retain the calendar in its basic form, so long were we part of the household of Judaism, so long was the unity of the Jewish people maintained. And when proposals for calendar reform come along, one can see today this unity expressed loudly and clearly. I don't know if you remember that in the 1930s and again in the 1960s, proposals were made for a new calendar. A calendar which would see to it that one could predict from year to year exactly what day of the week a certain date of the month would come on and know exactly, therefore, that one could open one school every 7th of September and it would be the first Monday in September, and one could collect taxes precisely on the 15th of January and the 15th of April and so on, know that these were days in which the post office was open to receive late returns, and businesses could organize themselves precisely from year to year without having to worry that a day that they set aside to be their annual meeting might fall on a Sunday and therefore be inappropriate the next year. And these proposals are relatively simple. They were proposals which have established a year of 365 days divided into four units of 3 months, each of those units having days of 30, a month of 31, 31, and 30 days, and an extra day called a World Day added at the end of the year, which would be a universal holiday of peace and fellowship. And once every 4 years during leap year, a World Day would be added in June as a second bonus. And if one establishes this calendar, then one is certain then that there will be a regularity to life. And all of the things that industry needs and colleges need, and even some of us might enjoy in our private lives, could come about. There'd be no more need to carry around with us a calendar to know exactly what the confusions may be that we face when we try and program or plan our lives. But when these proposals were made, the Jews and the Seventh-day Adventists, the two groups in life who believe and practice the Sabbath, for whom the Sabbath is always the seventh day following the seventh day, protested, because this kind of world calendar reform, whatever its other values, would have meant that the Sabbath would change the day of the week on which it falls from year to year, and would have been it would have become an impossible burden for truly observant Jews and Seventh-day Adventists, and indeed for all of us. We now are familiar with the pattern of worship with the Sabbath as Friday night to Saturday. And next year, if the world calendar reform were established, Friday night would be Thursday night and Friday. And the year, next year would be Wednesday night and Thursday. And the following year would be Tuesday night and Wednesday. You can imagine the chaos and the confusion that this would create. Well, Reform Jews and Orthodox Jews and secular Jews united in the 1960s and 1930s to protest this pragmatic reform, and as yet it has, of course, not been established. What I'm simply suggesting to you this morning is the calendar plays a much more important role in our lives than we normally pause to consider. It suggests precisely how much we are creatures of routine, how important to our mental health the pattern, the familiar, is, how when life seems erratic, we become nervous and indeed neurotic. The calendar, I would suggest to you, if you're ever asked, is perhaps the real reason why the Jewish people have survived as a united people. The calendar has given us a sense of weekly encouragement, and the calendar has bound scattered Israel together through all times and through all centuries. We've not agreed on much else, but we have agreed on the calendar. If you want to know the secret of Jewish survival, I would suggest that any answer that you might give must include, as a basic component, the willingness of Jewish communities throughout the world to maintain the calendar, basically, that was set down in the Torah. We bring to it different things. We allow the holidays to suggest to us different matrices of values, but we observe the holidays as one. And as long as we do, we shall remain one people. Amen.